time as far as One Step Beyond and KFJC public affairs listeners are concerned. The headline is, U.S. used Nazis to spy on Soviets, study says. That's right up there on the same level as water wet, scientists discover. Anyway, but the substance of the article is that the General Accounting Office, the GAO, has just released a report stating that, yes, son of a gun, that U.S. spy agencies recruited Nazi war criminals after World War II. The GAO, now a couple things to bear in mind before I read the article. The GAO says that the reason was that the ill-prepared intelligence system was suddenly ordered in 1946 to, quote, produce the highest possible quality of intelligence on the USSR in the shortest time possible, unquote. So basically it also says that the basic tenor of the article is that these naïfs who were thrown out into the world of Eastern Europe and told to go out and get those Soviets or bust, kind of reeling around as if in a daze, were suddenly seized upon and manipulated by these cruel Nazis, while themselves being, of course, the innocent apple-cheeked American boys aforementioned, didn't really quite know what was going on, and now we're just finding out about it. Well, anyway, that's the general summation going up to this part of the article, and we're going to talk about some numbers here in this article.
In other words, the tone here is basically that we were a bunch of innocents abroad and were victimized accordingly.
Indeed. Okay, skipping down to the middle of the article, the GAO, which again is the General Accounting Office, said the 1946 order came when U.S. forces were demobilized. The Office of Strategic Services, the wartime intelligence agency, was dismantled, and many experienced agents were home and pursuing private careers. Quote, their replacements, besides being inexperienced, were believed by some former intelligence officers we interviewed to be philosophically and politically, quote, naive about the beginning of the Cold War, the report said. Remember that, politically and philosophically naive. The GAO studied cases of 114 aliens, including Nazis and Axis collaborators, and identified five with undesirable or questionable backgrounds who were employed by U.S. intelligence agencies and received some form of assistance to immigrate. Quote, among the five assisted aliens were two alleged war criminals, a former Nazi SS officer, a convicted conspirator in an assassination, and a traitor, the report said. So, basically, the GAO here, while finding that our intelligence officers were perhaps politically and philosophically naive, or as Dave put it, innocents abroad, they studied 114 cases of aliens and found five of questionable or undesirable background. Well, remember that and listen closely to what Dave has to read now.
Well, again, today's Sunday Chronicle Examiner has a front-page story maintaining that Josef Mengele could have been caught by West German authorities. That story begins on page 1 of the Chron Examiner, today being Sunday, June 30th of 1985. It's continued on page A12, again, entitled Experts Say West Germany Could Have Caught Mengele. Now, the part of the article that we're going to concern ourselves with, and which is sort of going to provide the outline and the basis for much of tonight's broadcast, is a little section at the bottom here called Nazi Hunters Still Have War Criminals to Find. And as we said at the top here, all of you incipient Nazi hunters out there, we're going to give you a running jump on six of the nine war criminals that they list here. These, according to the Jewish Documentation Center, certainly the writers of this article, are the nine most wanted Nazi war criminals still on the lam. And they are, the article says, the three most wanted Nazi war criminals are Alois Brunner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R, remember that name, who was Adolf Eichmann's deputy. Operating in France, Brunner was responsible for deporting Jews to death camps and for the murders of anti-Nazi intellectuals. Sentenced in absentia to death by a French court, he was last seen in Syria. We're going to tell you the circumstances under which he was seen. Walter Kutschmann, K-U-T-S-C-H-M-A-N-N, whom U.S. Nazi hunters accuse of deporting 600,000 Jews to their deaths in extermination camps. They rank him second after Brunner on the most wanted list. Anton Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, commandant of the Theresienstadt concentration camp, whom Simon Wiesenthal puts second behind Brunner. Adolf Hitler commended Theresienstadt as a model camp, but refused to let Red Cross representatives see it. Some other leading targets. Ludwig Hahn, H-A-H-N, chief of the Gestapo in Warsaw, Poland, last seen in Hamburg, West Germany in 1961. Remember Hahn's name. We're going to come back to him. Heinrich Mueller, M-U-L-L-E-R, a Gestapo chief reportedly living in Argentina. We're going to touch back on Mueller as well. Walter Rauf, R-A-U-F-F, SS colonel at Auschwitz, at least according to these people, charged with killing 100,000 last seen in Chile. We're going to talk about Rauf, too. Alphonse Willem Sassen, S-A-S-S-E-N, SS captain wanted for mass murder in the Netherlands, last seen in Ecuador. Sassen, too, we're going to give you a tip about. Friedrich Schwend, S-C-H-W-E-N-D, SS colonel who counterfeited $500 million in British banknotes, also wanted for murder in Italy. Christian Wirtz, we're going to talk about Schwend, too. Christian Wirtz, W-I-R-T-H, commandant at Belzac concentration camp where tens of thousands were slaughtered. So, six of the nine, Brunner, Hahn, Mueller, Rauf, Sassen, and Schwend. We're going to give you a little tip on where some of you Nazi hunters can begin looking for these criminals on the lam.
Indeed. Now, the top of the list, you will notice, is a man named Alois Brunner, A-L-O-I-S, Brunner, B-R-U-N-N-E-R. Now, we're going to read to you a short segment here from a book entitled Galen, Spy of the Century, which, of course, longtime listeners are quite familiar with. The author is E.H. Cookridge. Spelled just like it sounds, C-O-O-K-R-I-D-G-E, and it was copyright 1971, published in the United States by Random House in hardcover. Now, bear in mind also that Cookridge is not an unsympathetic biographer to Reinhard Galen. This is not somebody who's trying to smear noble Reinhard with the tar and feathers of leftist political dogma.
Nick, before you get into the whereabouts of Brunner, one detail to remember now. In the General Accounting Office study that Nip Tuck read you at the beginning, They examined 114 aliens brought into the United States at the end of the war, found that five had suspicious fascist connections out of the 114 examined. We just read you a list of nine Nazi war criminals, considered to be the nine most wanted war criminals. Now, we're going to see what we find out about these nine.
Indeed. Now, before we talk about Reinhard Galen, who never seems to have made it onto anybody's most wanted list, although he was certainly a man that many people would have felt to have been a danger to freedom, democracy, and the American way. Reinhard Galen, of course, was Hitler's chief of staff for intelligence for Fremde Heere Ost, Foreign Armies East, in other words, the head of the Eastern Front Intelligence Center, dealing with Eastern Europe and Russia. At the end of the war, General Galen wound up by some strange mischance of fate working for the United States, as a matter of fact, before the war was over. After working for some time with the then just borning CIA, to which he transplanted his entire Nazi intelligence organization, he then went to work for the BND, as a matter of fact, helped to put together the BND. That's an important one because we're going to talk about it. The Bureau Nachrichtendienst. The BND is the West German equivalent of the CIA, and then later went on to round out his years working for NATO and NATO intelligence. Okay, so Reinhard Galen, the top Nazi spy master in the East, went to work for the CIA immediately after the war, and then helped to form the BND, the West German CIA, and ran that. Okay, again, reading from Cookridge's book, Galen, Spy of the Century, it says, at Damascus, meaning in Damascus, Syria, the BND resident, in other words, the resident agent of the West German CIA, was ex-SS Hauptsturmführer Alois Brunner, alias Jörg Fischer, who posed as a director of the German-Syrian trading company Otraco. Brunner later joined Bunch, that's Franz Bunch, in Cairo. They were old colleagues, for they had both worked under Eichmann at the RSHA Jewish Department. Now, bear in mind, not only was Alois Brunner the BND resident in Damascus, Syria, but that most of the work that the BND was doing in the Middle East at that time was, in fact, being done at the request of the CIA through General Galen. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But among other things, they helped to set up the Egyptian and later on the Libyan secret services at the request of the CIA, who they felt, the CIA felt that it would be too delicate for them to do. So they sent in Galen and his ex-SS men and his ex-intelligence men to set these things up. So one finds it rather difficult to believe that the United States did not know that the BND resident in charge of Damascus, Syria, was in fact a man by the name of Alois Brunner. So at least at one point in time, and others that we've talked about, one of the most wanted man on the war criminals list was a resident intelligence agent for one of our chief allies in the West, and indirectly for our own intelligence services through the Galen Organization.
Right. By the way, Bruner's work for the Galen Organization can also be confirmed from the book that I'm about to read you from called The Borman Brotherhood, authored by William Stevenson, S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N, not to be confused with the William Stevenson, also known as Intrepid. Different spelling on that, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N. Both do write about World War II in Europe, and both worked for the British during World War II. Now, another man on that list, a fellow by the name of Ludwig Hahn, H-A-H-N, also worked for the Galen Organization. By the way, William Stevenson's The Borman Brotherhood, published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. There's also a softcover edition published by Bantam, both copyrighted 1973. This is the hardcover edition, reading about Ludwig Hahn, one of the other most wanted war criminals. Speaking here writing here, really, Stevenson is writing of something called the Brown Book, which is an East German book about Nazi war criminals, and he's referring to this in connection with the Polish lawyer's search for Nazi war criminals. And what Stevenson's doing here is testing the veracity of the East German Brown Book information. Referring to the Brown Book, there were details referring to men like Ludwig Hahn, H-A-H-N, Nazi Party member number 194,465, appointed deputy chief of the Gestapo in Hanover, promoted to SS major and transferred to Gestapo Berlin, and given the task between 1941 and 44 of running the Nazi security police in Warsaw, which in that period was the setting for one of history's worst reigns of terror. Official Nazi Party documents were cited whose authenticity seemed beyond doubt. Hahn was in command of the security forces which resettled, unquote, some 500,000 Jews in gas chambers at Treblinka and liquidated the Warsaw Ghetto. By this time, I knew that the Polish lawyer's interest in the fate of the Warsaw Jews was very personal. He had studied in England, had absorbed liberal intellectual ideas, but he could not forget that his own parents were Jews who had died in Auschwitz. To test the accuracy of his information, I looked more closely at the case of Ludwig Hahn. His profession was given as that of deputy director of a life insurance company based in Karlsruhe. The company was a cover for the West German intelligence service, and Hahn was a senior officer in that organization. Any further inquiries were met with blank stares. So Ludwig Hahn, also working for the Galen Organization. This was about 1964 when Stevenson was checking this out here. And again, as it turns out, the information contained in the Brown Book turned out to be accurate insofar as Stevenson was able to verify. So a second one of these nine most wanted war criminals, also working for the Galen Organization, according to information presented in the Borman Brotherhood by William Stevenson.
And fairly highly placed, according to Stevenson. Okay, the next gentleman that we're going to talk about, and of course the term is being used loosely, is a man by the name of Alphonse Willem Sassen, S-A-S-S-E-N. The information about Herr Sassen is coming from Aftermath by Ladislaus Farrago, F-A-R-A-G-O, an excellent book. If you haven't read it, it's also out in paperback. The edition that we have, however, is a hardcover, a 1974 copyright, and published by Simon & Schuster. But I do know there is a paperback edition out because I've got it, and you might want to check it out. It's a fascinating story, and it will shed some light also on the Mengele thing going on now, too. Okay, but anyway, back to Herr Sassen, S-A-S-S-E-N. Okay, they're talking about the fact that that Sassen was in contact with Adolf Eichmann when Eichmann was one of the most wanted war criminals in the world before he was finally located and kidnapped by the Israelis. And the fact that Sassen was in contact with Eichmann and that Eichmann gave a great deal of his story to Sassen. Of course, Sassen knew Eichmann because of his own involvement in the Warsaw Ghetto and in a similar line of work for the Nazis. But anyway, so Eichmann told his story to Sassen when he was one of the world's most wanted war criminals, and later on, then Eichmann took the big fall and was picked up by the Israelis. Anyway, so reading from Aftermath, Farrago writes, "When Eichmann was captured, Sassen no longer felt bound by their agreement. This was too good an opportunity to be missed by this Dutchman who was always hard up for cash. On September 10th, 1960, about 4 months after Eichmann's abduction, Sassen revealed the existence of the manuscript in an interview in La Razón, a Buenos Aires daily. By then it was in the hands of brokers abroad, peddling it to the highest bidder. World rights were then sold to Time, Inc., in New York, and Life magazine published some 25,000 words from the 208,500-word manuscript in two installments on November 28th and December 5th, 1960. The editors of Life were appalled by the unvarnished brutality and unrepentance of Eichmann's confessions, and they hesitated for some time before publishing their carefully selected excerpts. In the end, they printed them with an apologetic preface, calling their gruesome scoop, quote, a major contribution to the history of a horrifyingly brutal era. So, whatever else Willem Sassen has been involved in 1960, he was selling articles to Life magazine. Of course, Time Life Incorporated, the Loose Empire, L-U-C-E, not L-O-O-S-E, although I suppose that's a debatable point. But the Loose Empire, of course, one of the leading propaganda centers for anti-communism since back in the 20s. And to a large extent, not responsible, but certainly helped to fan the flames of McCarthyism in this country because of their strong support for the people who accused the State Department of losing China to communism and the State Department of being filled with communists. So anyway, in 1960, we don't see them too absolutely worried about publishing a manuscript from a man who has later turned out to be, according to this list, one of the most wanted war criminals in the world.
Okay, so basically, now, of course, Hahn and Alois Brunner last heard working for the Galen Organization. You Nazi hunters can check perhaps with Langley, Virginia, and then Pulak, West Germany, for the latest whereabouts of those individuals. And also, reportedly, Alois Brunner, according to Galen, Spy of the Century, was killed by a bomb in the Middle East, too. So he may actually be dead, but the deaths of Nazi war criminals remains a moot subject here. Okay, and as far as Alphonse Willem Sassen, Nazi hunters can contact Time Life Incorporated and see perhaps if they have a forwarding address for Mr. Sassen.
A contributor's address. Just see where he endorsed the check. I should just mention before Dave starts that you are listening to KFJC 89.7 Los Altos Hills.
Okay, so there's three of the nine most wanted Nazi war criminals here. We're going to talk about number four here. This is a fellow named Friedrich Schwend, S-C-H-W-E-N-D, reading now from a book called The Nazi Legacy, subtitled Klaus Barbie and the International Fascist Connection. Three authors here, a man named Magnus Linklater, L-I-N-K-L-A-T-E-R, Isabel Hilton, H-I-L-T-O-N, and Neil Asherson, A-S-C-H-E-R-S-O-N, all British newspaper editors, specifically Linklater of the London, managing editor of the London Observer, Isabel Hilton is Latin American correspondent for the London Sunday Times, Asherson, senior foreign correspondent of the London Observer, okay? Now, Friedrich Schwend, by the way, Friedrich Schwend is an SS colonel who, according to a number of people, including the San Francisco Chronicle, who ran his obituary in early April of 1980, is dead. So he may also not be with us. However, those of you looking to pick up his trail might go to Italy, where one of the things we've talked about in connection with Friedrich Schwend in the past concerns the fact that he has set up something called Operation Bernhard, referred to in that article, which was a project in which American and British currency was forged, in which the forged currency then exchanged for gold bullion. This used to finance a number of Nazi activities at the end of World War II, including the flight of SS men and war criminals, also used in connection with the Vatican to help get some of those criminals across via the rat line, according to David Yallop, again, author of In God's Name, the rat line set up by SS Oberlieutenant Licio Gelli, who went on to head up the P2 Lodge, and we've talked about him almost ad nauseum, got some good stuff about the Pope shooting next week, but that's one of the things Friedrich Schwend did, and Nip, I notice you're interested in saying something here.
Gesticulating. Well, a couple of different things. Of course, not only the fact that we should mention not only was Licio Gelli an Oberleutnant in the SS, but of course he also was a guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration. Just thought we should knock that in there. But one of the interesting things that sometimes we get into this real, the minutia here, and just a very simple point of logic that needs to be made here, which is that, okay, here we have a list supposedly from the most up-to-date sources of the nine most wanted war criminals in the world. Well, as Dave and I will tell you, according to some fairly easy-to-obtain sources, because neither Dave or I have security clearances, and neither Dave and I have friends in Congress or anything, some fairly easily obtained sources. Several of these men are dead. Okay, this puts you in a logical fork in the road. You have to go one way or the other. Either these people are dead, In which case, why are they on the most wanted list, and why are we being jerked around, so to speak, by being offered these scapegoats if they're already dead? Or two, do some other people know things that we don't know, and which, of course, raises the specter that maybe so-called and suspected dead Nazi war criminals are not, in fact, dead at all, and that quite a few people are aware of that fact. So, just two ways to go with that, but it's got to be one of those two, and you might want to think that over in your free time.
Of Klaus Barbie, or of Friedrich Schwenn, rather. Now, he worked with Klaus Barbie both in Latin America and in Europe after World War II. And like Klaus Barbie, Friedrich Schwenn worked for U.S. intelligence. Reading now from the Nazi Legacy by Linklater, Hilton, and Asherson. At the end of the war, like Klaus Barbie, Schwenn worked for the Americans before escaping to South America. U.S. documents reveal that after passing into the hands of the 44th CIC detachment, that's Counterintelligence Corps detachment, he was used as an informant by American intelligence agencies in Austria, the Austrian Tyrol, and Meran, North Italy. So Friedrich Schwenn apparently also worked for U.S. counterintelligence. Now, in an article from Parade magazine entitled The Children of Azieu, I-Z-I-E-U, it mentioned in connection with Friedrich Schwenn that he worked also for the CIA in Latin America. We also looked at information which talked about a guy named Fritz Schwenn, which is one of the names that Friedrich Schwenn uses, who apparently, under the name of Bender, Mr. Frank Bender, helped set up, among other things, the Bay of Pigs invasion. That, according to information presented by Henrik Kruger in the Great Heroin Coup. So certainly, Fritz Schwenn worked for U.S. counterintelligence, for military intelligence, and according to information from the Children of Azieu, and perhaps corroborated by Henrik Kruger in the Great Heroin Coup, for the CIA in Latin America as well. So we have the four Nazi war criminals of the nine most wanted we've looked at so far. Three of the four turned out to work for U.S. intelligence. The fourth is a contributor to Time Life Incorporated Life magazine. And two of the four, Fritz Schwenn and Alois Brunner, are supposedly dead. So the search continues.
The search continues. This is like a game show. Find the Nazi. Okay.
By the way, one of the people who came over on the rat line set up by Jelly and financed by Operation Bernhard was a guy named Walter Rauf.
Ah, yes. Walter Rauf. And, of course, Walter Rauf is where we're going to turn our focus of attention. Plus, we're going to deal specifically with one of the particular innocents abroad that Dave alluded to earlier, a man by the name of Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA for quite some time, right up through the Kennedy administration, and an interesting character himself. But again, as previously mentioned, somebody who was in over his head and perhaps a little politically naive.
Incidentally, this particular naive, this ingenue, was fired by Kennedy for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs invasion, according to which, of course, we've talked about in connection with the Kennedy assassination ad infinitum. According to Henrik Kruger, that was set up by, in part at least, by Fritz Schwenn, acting under the name of Frank Bender.
These folks do get around. Well, this short segment of an article is from the London Times for May 31st, 1984. May Brussel supplied us with this particular article, and it's just a tiny little segment under a picture of Alan Dulles, and it says, "The late Alan Dulles, above, once head of the CIA, arranged the escape from justice of the Nazi war criminal Walter Rauf. Mr. John Loftus, a former Justice Department investigator, claimed in Boston. He said it happened when Mr. Dulles worked for the wartime OSS, the CIA's predecessor. Rauf died in Chile 2 weeks ago." Well, a couple things to be mentioned real quickly. John Loftus, of course, the Justice Department investigator, the author of The Ballara Secret, a book we've used quite a bit. And when it comes to the specifics, we have not yet had any problems with any of Mr. Loftus's information. It has checked out all the way down the line, and one would hope it would, because he seems to be a man of goodwill, and he especially has a lot better access to internal sources than we do. But anyway, as Loftus says, Alan Dulles helped Walter Rauf to escape. Walter Rauf was essentially Adolf Eichmann's predecessor. Walter Rauf was heading up the group of people that constructed the mobile killing vans that first made it possible for the final solution to be implemented in large order. In other words, instead of having to take people out, human beings out, and individually shoot them, Walter Rauf helped make it possible to herd them into big trucks and gas them on the way to the crematorium. Now, Walter Rauf, as mentioned, was aided by Alan Dulles to escape prosecution, wound up in Chile, where, according to some sources, including Donald Freed, he wound up heading up the Colonia Dignidad prison camp in Chile, which Pinochet used to not only to punish his enemies, but basically to destroy political opposition. And we hear several sources have alleged that it was also used to import various other Nazis in to teach different kinds of anti-insurgency techniques and torture and things of that nature. And Walter Rauf was almost certainly one of those people.
So, again, Amnesty International is one of the people from whom those reports come regarding the involvement of Walter Rauf in the in Pinochet's prison system in Chile, and whether or not he actually worked for U.S. intelligence. Of course, U.S. intelligence was very much involved in putting Pinochet in power. He certainly was assisted by Alan Dulles and by the Rat Line and Operation Bernhard in the Vatican in escaping from Europe over to Latin America, so, and also reportedly died in the spring of 1984. So here's a fourth, a third reportedly dead Nazi war criminal, certainly helped by Alan Dulles, one of these naïfs who were so thoroughly thoroughly taken aback and hamstrung by these insidious Nazi war criminals. That naïf being Alan Dulles, again fired for lying to Kennedy about the Bay of Pigs, later served on the Warren Commission, which concluded there was no conspiracy in the assassination of President Kennedy.
Yes, and lest you think that that this sarcasm at the expense of Alan Dulles is completely unwarranted and merely a product of say Dave and I being on the payroll of the Soviet Union or another enemy of freedom and democracy, we're going to get back to Alan Dulles a little later on.
We're deliberately laying the sarcasm on a little heavy here, so hopefully it's not too distasteful. It's heading towards something, so when we come down to it, perhaps if it isn't already pretty clear exactly why we're being so sarcastic here, hopefully will be. Okay, on to another one of these Nazi war criminals we're trying to search out here. This is a fellow named Heinrich Müller, last name M-U-E-L-L-E-R, head of the Gestapo during World War II. And a couple of weeks ago, reading from the book we're going to read another section from right now, that book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, we took a look at Müller's operations in helping to set up the security apparatus for Nazi war criminals abroad. And specifically, we took a look at his activities in providing some dead doubles with dental work, very similar to that by Martin Bormann, meant to fool investigators later about Bormann's whereabouts. We also looked at Mueller's placing of three skeletons in his own grave, which was then regularly and dutifully visited by his family. And it turns out none of the skeletons was anything like Heinrich Mueller's. Now, Mueller in Latin America became basically the chief of security for the entire Nazi exile apparatus in Latin America. We've talked about that before, and we'll get into that at greater length in the future. But basically, this very tight-knit Nazi security apparatus, which has provided the cover for many of the Nazi war criminals living in South America, including Martin Bormann, this particular group has worked hand-in-glove with the CIA upon occasion. Again, reading from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyrighted 1981. Of Heinrich Müller and his security apparatus in Latin America, they say, the CIA could have pulled aside the gray curtain that obscured Bormann at any time, but the CIA and Müller's crack organization of former SS men found it to their mutual advantage to cooperate in many situations. There is no morality in the sense that most of us know it in the strange world of professional secrecy, and when it was to the advantage of each to work together, they did so. And still later, referring to this group of Nazi war criminals in South America, Manning writes as follows, Mueller never leaves Latin America, but his agents roam the Americas and Europe. They provide protection for the NSDAP leadership in exile who can still manage to travel to Madrid, Sweden, Switzerland, France, Italy, or North Africa. And they have been known to take on lucrative secret police assignments, one of those assignments on behalf of CIA described here as follows. When Colonel Nasser became president of Egypt, he asked the CIA for assistance in establishing a similar organization in his country. The CIA did not wish to become directly involved and so referred him to General Galen, then chief of the West German Federal Intelligence Organization, which was in fact maintained by the CIA. And we've talked about that this particular operation in the past. It's on our Radio Free America number 3. Basically, Heinrich Müller dispatched a bunch of top Nazi war criminals to Latin America at the behest of Otto Skorzeny, and who in turn was acting at the direction of Hjalmar Schacht, who we spoke about last week, finance minister of Nazi Germany, the man who basically put together Hitler's war machine using the very powerful German-American industrial connections we talked about on Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Those connections were maintained throughout the course of the war, and Schacht was very active through those connections during and after World War II. But remember, Heinrich Müller, working using his SS exile organization, has worked, according to Paul Manning, who researched many of these things firsthand, hand in glove with the CIA. So another one of these Nazi war criminals, once again working with U.S. intelligence, if not directly for them.
Okay, rather than taking a break, because we started so late, I think we're going to plunge ahead here with some more information, perhaps get it wrapped up and still have time to run some phone calls before I leave at 10 o'clock. I'm going to go on now and sort of start to tie some strings together sort of philosophically. Now, one of the things to think about here, okay, and one of the things that we've talked about is, all right, if the a question that's been asked is, if the Nazi hierarchy, if Hitler and others in the Nazi hierarchy were so profoundly anti-religion, feeling that it undercut Aryan nationalism and was, and the Roman Catholic Church or something like that was a non-Aryan creed and things of this nature, how did these things get hooked up together, as we've talked about, and the many connections? Well, there's several different levels to look at. Obviously, there is the level of convenience. And in many ways, the Nazis seem to be a convenience for the Catholic Church up to and through a large part of World War II because of their stated mission to destroy Bolshevism, which has always been considered by the more conservative elements of the Catholic Church, which are Legion, to be the number one enemy of the Mother Church on Earth.
It's worth noting, too, that there was a similarity between the support of the Vatican for Nazi Germany and the support of the Vatican for certain fascist elements around the world, particularly in Latin America today. This support for these, this fascism and anti-communism of a murderous variety has often taken place at the expense of lower-down members of the Catholic Church. The Nazis did persecute relatively low-ranking Nazi clerics in Germany who protested their policy to a considerable extent, just as a great many Catholic priests have been assassinated by death squads in Latin America. Yet the Vatican, the higher-ups, continue to support these policies despite the implications of those policies for their brethren within the church when those brethren are a little lower down than they are.
Indeed. Now, something also to look at here that perhaps is not always taken into account is the fact that until you have done some reading on the Nazi era, and as with any other political grouping, you may not be aware that, or you may not have had the chance to be aware, that, of course, there are many, many different levels of involvement and many different levels of political ideals and political expediency. And within the Nazi hierarchy, there were several different groups and factions playing off against each other, and as always happens in these situations, struggling within the unit for power, even while their overall support was directed outward to keep the entire party and the entire German war state moving forward. Now, one of these groups of people, and this perhaps answers some other questions, including the connections with the Catholic Church after World War II, and including a lot of connections between the right-wing in America and the Catholic Church and things of that nature, is that quite a few of the people who were attracted to the Nazis were not necessarily doctrinaire pan-Aryan types so much as they were your basic garden variety right-wingers. They were fascists, although they were fascists before there were fascists. It's like the country before country was cool. They were fascists before fascism was in fashion. And many of them were, of course, the ruling classes of Prussia and Bavaria and other German states. And they were attracted to Nazism because of its explicitly elitist nature in terms of the inferior races and the inferior countries and the inferior cultures. So one of the things that happened is when Hitler began to waver, or when Hitler's war progress began to waver, there were a lot of people making plans within the Nazi hierarchy to keep the basic format of fascism, but to perhaps get rid of Hitler. And among these people were the upper class, many of them themselves members of the Catholic Church with connections into the right wing of the Catholic Church, and the extremely anti-communist right wing of the Catholic Church, and the right wing in the United States and Britain and obviously France and other Western nations. So one of the things that happened then is that as the war effort began to fall apart and people were talking about deals, many of the connections made were not between Hitler's diehard pan-Aryan people, but between the more expedient fascists who merely had their monetary interests and their political interests in mind and didn't really give a fig for Hitler's philosophy of Aryan supremacy as long as they were on top. It was more personal supremacy and financial supremacy, and they got into touch with a lot of the right-wingers in other countries, and this is where a lot of the deals that were made after the war. Now, we talked about political naivete, and that's what we're going to go on and talk about now.
It's worth noting here, too, that a lot of these people were in business together, as we've noted in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, also in our first couple of Radio Free America shows. Many of these people were actually involved together in a North Atlantic industrial and financial axis that, again, we spoke about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Radio Free America. Alan Dulles, the innocent abroad that we spoke of earlier, was one of the people who was involved through the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, along with his brother John Foster, later Secretary of State, while Alan Dulles was CIA director. They were involved with through the Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell with many of these German industries, and also a fellow we talked about some last week, a guy named Hjalmar Schacht, who was the finance minister of Nazi Germany up till the outbreak of the war, and basically was one of the primary operators of this German-American industrial and financial axis, utilizing that tangle of connections that we've talked about in the past to basically put together Hitler's war machine. So many of these people had been in business before and during the war and simply maintained and activated ongoing commercial and financial connections in order, as Niptuck indicated, to begin setting up a more viable fascist grouping, international grouping, than the Pan-Aryan organization put together by Hitler, and which we, of course, know as the Third Reich.
Now, before I read you this section, I'm going to read you another short section that kind of lays some of this stuff out in terms of how these kinds of connections came together. In this case, they're talking about a man named Walter Schellenberg. Walter Schellenberg, by the end of the war, became the head of SD Division, or Amt 6, as they called it. The SD, of course, was the intelligence wing of the SS. The SS, of course, was the, whatever you want to call it, the killer elite of Nazi Germany. Now, in this case, they're talking about a man named Max von Hohenlohe, H-O-H-E-N-L-O-H-E, who was, I guess, petty, Bavarian nobility? Nobility?
I'm not sure exactly where he was from. He was a Catholic nobleman who also had very important industrial and diplomatic connections, and using those connections became an important Third Reich spy and diplomat.
Okay. Now, they're talking about serving Himmler's cause. Again, the point here is Himmler as divorced from Hitler, because Himmler was not a pan-Aryanist. He was, but he was more willing to serve political expediency, especially in terms of connecting with the Catholic Church.
Worth noting, too, that von Hohenlohe, Prince Max von Hohenlohe's wife, Princess Stephanie von Hohenlohe, herself actually a Jew by birth, she became a so-called honorary Aryan, also was very active on behalf of the Third Reich, both for diplomatic and espionage purposes in the United States. You'll see Stephanie von Hohenlohe's name mentioned quite a bit as well.
Okay. Now, reading again from the book, oh, I didn't mention it, did I? This is from American Swastika. We mentioned it earlier in the evening. It's by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M, the same guy who wrote Trading with the Enemy. This is a brand new book, just came out in 1985. The hardback edition is from Doubleday and Company. No paperback out yet.
This, again, for people who are attempting to convince other people of some of this, and some people have expressed some exasperation in the past, this book will go a long way toward convincing people, and it is current.
We're going to get to some great stuff in this book in just a moment. Okay, now again, setting up Schellenberg, and also these kinds of connections that were beginning to be made as the war effort was falling apart. Says, not only Max von Hohenlohe and his second cousin Stephanie served Himmler's cause, other figures of the SS or SD inner circle were the Grand Duke of Mecklenburg, Prince Wilhelm of Hesse, and the Prince von Hohenzollern. The Hohenzollerns, by the way, were the family of which Kaiser Wilhelm was a member, who ruled Germany for a long time. Most of the Prussian elite, few of whom approved of Hitler, gravitated happily to Himmler. They were prepared to overlook Himmler's depressing origins and undistinguished occupation as a chicken farmer because of the unique power he wielded, his lip service to Catholicism, and his international connections. He had substantial investments in the United States. Only his personal loyalty to Hitler, as much a petty bourgeois loyalty as anything else, prevented this cluster of right-wing Nazis from securing his support in their various attempts to remove Hitler and to set up an international front against Russia. However, they could rely on such upper-middle-class figures as Franz Seeks of SD Amt 7. Of course, we've talked about Franz Seeks a long time. He was the man, one of the men sprung from the docket at Nuremberg by Reinhard Gehlen so he could help the United States set up the special forces. Okay, going along. However, they could rely on such upper-middle-class figures as Franz Seeks, who was later aided and abetted by U.S. intelligence, and above all, Walter Schellenberg, who combined a solid upper-middle-class background with a reliably lower-middle-brow intelligence. Okay, that's Walter Schellenberg. Now, we're going to skip along and find out about a mission that von Hohenlohe took on the part of Walter Schellenberg and who he set up a meeting with and what happened. In December 1942, Schellenberg spent much of the time in Switzerland, negotiating with a special local emissary, Roger Masson, or Masson, M-A-S-S-O-N, in meetings with British consular officials. In January 1943, he authorized Hohenlohe to meet with Alan W. Dulles in person at a point of contact in Geneva. Alan Dulles was ideally chosen in the matter. Bear in mind now, this is, first of all, the person that the GAO report that just came out, this is one of the people that presumably was a political naive, and secondarily, this is the man who Kennedy wanted to, who fired and wanted to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces because of, and who in fact was the head of intelligence in the United States for many years after World War II. Okay. Alan Dulles was ideally chosen in the matter. Oh, and by the way, he and his brother John Foster Dulles were, if I'm not correct, members of the Sovereign Military. No, not Knights of Malta. They were...
No, those are the Buckleys.
The Buckleys. But the Dulleses are connected in there somewhere, too. I'm trying to remember what it was. Never mind. We'll get back to it. It'll come to me.
Could be.
There was a connection that we talked about back when we were first doing the Pope thing.
Well, I don't know about the Vatican. They both were very much involved with the Vatican at various times.
Yeah.
But they connected together not only through the Eisenhower administration, but also through the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell.
Indeed.
So they were brothers in more than just the genetic sense.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to that if I think of it. Okay, but the main thing, as we mentioned before, is this is the so-called political naïf, according to the GAO office, the one of the people who made these contacts with these Nazi officials, and as mentioned before, also the top-ranking U.S. intelligence man for a long time. Alan Dulles was ideally chosen in the matter, Haim writes. Both he and his brother John Foster had extensive German connections. John Foster had been American representative at the Conference for the Regulation of Germany's Foreign Indebtedness, which had resulted in 1933 in the reduction under the Hitler regime of such indebtedness overseas. He, Dulles, had acted as an attorney for General Franco and as a director of the International Nickel Company, which was charged with trading with the enemy in World War II. He was a single-minded and impassioned opponent of the Soviet Union who was to play a crucial role in the post-war confrontations that provoked the Cold War. Alan Dulles was legal advisor to and a director of the Anglo-German Schroeder Banking Empire. The New York branch, which he represented, was a subsidiary of the London, Cologne, and Hamburg Schroeders. The Stein Bank of Cologne, under Chairman Kurt von Schroeder, was a chief financier of Himmler and of the hardcore SS inner circle. Even when he went to Switzerland in 1942, given carte blanche by the Vichy government, one of his law partners, Delano Andrews, took his place, thus securing the continued connection. The Swiss offshoot of the Schroeder Bank was one of Dulles' men, a director of the New York branch, Lada Mokarski, who conveniently was also U.S. vice consul in Zurich. The American minister in Bern was Leland Harrison, who authorized shipments of oil of enemy origin through Switzerland in World War II, as well as allowing American oil companies to fuel the German and Hungarian embassies and consulates, and the Germans to retain Standard Oil barges on the Rhine, rentals of which were paid to New York for the duration. Dulles, when he arrived in Switzerland, made contact with the so-called opposition movement in Germany. This is in 1943, including Schellenberg, Kaltenbrunner, that's Ernst Kaltenbrunner, Hjalmar Schacht, and others. Realizing that Hitler was losing the war, they sought to save their own necks and their financial alliances by making a separate peace. Since they opposed Hitler, who, as a nationalist and patriot, was determined to act against such internationalism, they would be able to re-secure the fascist alliance for the indefinite future. and they could also join with Dulles in whitewashing this activity in the eyes of the public, which was bamboozled into thinking that they were idealists and potential forgers of a new Germany.
By the way, Alan Dulles was in Switzerland as the OSS representative in Bern. Hjalmar Schacht, who we spoke about last week, was also in Switzerland for part of this period where he apparently was, he had traveled to Switzerland, allegedly to repair his health. Switzerland, by the way, was the site of something called the Bank for International Settlements, which was an institution through which many of these German and American financiers and industrialists associated before, during, and after World War II. There's been many questions as yet to be resolved about what Schacht was doing, possibly in connection with the BIS, and where Alan Dulles was also in the same country at the same time.
Okay, now, skipping along, we're going to talk about a meeting between Max von Hohenlohe, operating as a go-between for Schellenberg, and Alan Dulles. The records of this meeting come from the SS's own records made during wartime, during 1943. As author Haya mentions at the bottom, there have been numerous attempts made to discredit these records, none of which have succeeded so far. We have to take these as being as close to authentic as possible, despite the fact that they are SS records, because of the fact that numerous attempts have been made and none of them have been able to pull these records apart. Okay, the meeting with Hohenlohe was as pleasant for Dulles as it was for the prince. Records of the encounter show that there were three conversations in all in Bern and Geneva, the last of them taking place on April 3rd. The SS records are clearly authentic. Fortunately, I, meaning Haim, have obtained the documents from the files of a reliable source in England via Professor Klaus von Klemperer, professor of history at Smith College. There is, in my mind, no doubt of their authenticity. Okay, also bear in mind this meeting is taking place in January of 1943, while American servicemen are fighting the Nazis in Africa at that time and preparing to launch the D-Day invasion. Dulles greeted Hohenlohe in a most friendly manner. The two men realized that they had met in Vienna in 1916 and again in New York in the 1920s. Dulles said he was happy to see Hohenlohe again, after such a long time, in order to exchange ideas, for Hohenlohe had such an astute mind as far as European affairs were concerned. Dulles said he was, quote, sick and tired of listening to stories of ruined politicians, emigrants, and prejudiced Jews. In his opinion, a peace should be achieved that all parties would be interested in maintaining. He said that the German state had to remain in existence to maintain order and begin reconstruction, that the Czech question was of small importance. In other words, the Czech question, the property that that Germany took in 1939 that came very close to precipitating the beginning of World War II, which actually didn't start until the incursion into Poland. But it was necessary, this is Dulles still talking, but it was necessary to form a cordon sanitaire against Bolshevism and Pan-Slavism by, quote, enlarging Poland toward the east and maintaining Romania and a strong Hungary, unquote. He believed, this is still Dulles, he believed that planned industrial production after the war, led by Germany's industries, would be desirable. Under no circumstances were the Russians to be admitted to Romania or Asia Minor. The British might enter into negotiations with the Russians over spheres of interest, but the United States would like to maintain, quote, a modern and well-organized Europe as a high-income zone, market, and...